episode of the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn right here on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Mari Pack.
And I'm Christine Stoddard, your co-host.
Every week, our team will interview a different badass cis or trans woman who's doing something incredible for the Brooklyn community. Any line of work, professional or volunteer, will do. Today, we are so pleased to bring on Joanna Valente. Welcome, Joanna.
Hey, I'm here to be happy to be here.
We are so happy to have you.
Yeah.
If you're in tune with Brooklyn's literary scene, you may already recognize her name. Joanna Valente is a poet, writer, and community educator. She is the author of three poetry collections, Sirs and Madams, The Gods Are Dead, Marys of the Sea, and Xenos. She received her MFA in writing at Sarah Lawrence College. She is also the founder of Yes Poetry, as well as the managing editor for Luna Luna magazine and Civil Coping Mechanisms. Her writing has appeared in Prelude, The Atlas Review, The Feminist Wire, Bust, Pouch, and elsewhere. She also teaches workshops at Brooklyn Poets, a nonprofit organization that celebrates our borough's literary heritage.
Ooh.
Ooh, wow.
So what the heck is that? What is Brooklyn Poets?
So Brooklyn Poets is basically half literary magazine, half lit community. I think that's the best way I could put it. I was introduced to it about 2 years ago when I met Jason Koo at a Brooklyn Poets reading, which is part of what the organization does, is that it hosts, usually I would say, monthly readings. And the readings entail a workshop an hour before the reading, and then there's an open mic, and then there's the feature, who normally is supposed to be like an established poet. And we ended up just talking, he ended up buying my book, and then I became a feature at one of the readings and taught one of the workshops. And then he ended up asking me to teach like an ongoing workshop. And that's part of the organization, is that there are usually quarterly workshops taught by anywhere between 5 to 10 people a quarter. So now I do that. I've so far taught 3 classes. So it's really just like, I would say, a nonprofit dedicated to creating a lit community in New York City, although Brooklyn is obviously the sort of specified destination. There's also a sort of like off branch of Brooklyn Poets called Poets Bridge, which is a website meant to connect people all over the country or really all over the globe, where you can be mentored by a poet and not have to actually meet them. And it's all through online communication.
Neat.
I like that you use not have to meet them, because the burden of meeting poets is sometimes very immense.
It's kind of the worst.
It is. No, I have like a poet friend, and she and I talk about this a lot, that like, I was like, yeah, I really have this problem with, like, dating poets. She goes, oh, I learned that lesson way long ago. Like, poets are, like, just for friends, and, like, even then, sometimes to keep it a distance.
Too much.
It's kind of true.
So what is the experience of meeting all these different poets and teaching them?
It's really interesting, actually, for me, because I've always taught level one classes, so I tend to teach more experience to intermediate writers, although you always get a mix, because sometimes, like, I do get experienced writers in my classes just because they need a workshop and they want to take it with me, and it doesn't really matter in the long run because it's just people talking. But it's always kind of interesting because I feel like I always get a different perspective, in the sense that if I'm meeting a lot of my students who maybe aren't always the most experienced within the lit community, it kind of takes me out of it and, like, really makes me evaluate, like, why I write the way I do and really think about aesthetic. Because, like, is my aesthetic actually, like, getting me somewhere, or is it better? No one's aesthetic is better. And I think this is the great thing about teaching, is that you sort of realize, like, how to actually teach to each individual as opposed to being biased, because you think, like, oh, this couplet looks really great and I have to teach everything to be a couplet or something like that. In terms of meeting random poets just because of the actual readings, I think it's at once really amazing just to see that maybe a poet that you admire a lot from afar is an actual human who's, like, really probably not that cool.
So true.
Which in many ways is humbling, but then it's also kind of interesting to, like, the idea of celebrity, like, even though poets aren't celebrities, like, to you, like, they're these, like, cool beings. And I was lucky to read with Kim Adonisio, who, like, I loved since I was in high school. And it was interesting meeting her, just because on one hand, like, she was amazing and her poems, of course, were great. But then it's also interesting because you imagine these people with, like, different voices, you know, people can read somehow. And you, like, think that they're, like, got their life together, and they really don't.
No, they're mess-ups like the rest of us.
Yeah.
I feel like poets are even more of mess-ups.
It's true.
Like, the more poets I meet, I'm like, oh, that's why you're writing, because your life sure. is
you're
such
broken.
A... You're broken. You're broken. Your life is so chaotic that you have to transform it into something to make meaning. Which is, once sure. again, relates to, like, do not date, maybe do not befriend, no. is that if someone is, like, a truly amazing artist, that maybe there is some telling in that.
Yeah, well, actually, on that note, I was curious about the kind of diversity that you find at the readings and in the classes.
Sure.
Because Brooklyn is changing.
Oh,
Brooklyn
sure.
has changed. Who comes to these events and workshops?
So, yeah, that's the interesting thing for me, because a lot of my workshop students actually aren't typical writers. Like, I have a lot of, like, say, software engineers or, like, Facebook employees or just, like, people who've never actually written a poem before.
Wow.
So it's really interesting for me because they're looking at it from a complete outsider point of view, and I find that actually really refreshing because not everything has to do with, like, being friends with, like, everyone. At the same time, though, I think the readings tend to garner more poets than the workshops themselves, because a lot of people sign up through the workshop from, like, finding out on Google, like, that Brooklyn Poets exist, where, like, usually you find out about the readings because you're Facebook friends with someone who ends up inviting you to a reading. So it does tend to be, like, more clicky that way, in the sense that it's not clicky in a bad way, but everybody tends to know each other. I always liked the readings, though, because I feel like everyone who goes to them genuinely wants to be there. Which makes sense, because you have to workshop for an hour before. So it's like, if you don't really feel like workshopping, or if you think, like, your work is too good to be criticized,
uh-oh.
Or, like, you don't want to actually, like, write a poem or sit through an open mic, then, like, you're probably not going to go to a Brooklyn Poets reading. So I often feel like the people there are very genuine and, like, actually want to engage with you, which I find to be more rewarding, as opposed to someone showing up because it's, like, an NYU reading and, like,
yeah.
you have to go because you have to be seen at, like, a lit event by so-and-so.
Does the organization try to do outreach in the community to get different kinds of people to come to the events?
To be honest, I'm not really sure on that front, because I mostly just teach for it, so I don't really do any of the marketing, but I know Jason is really great about getting diverse poets in the workshops and, like, actually showcasing them on the website. He's also part of so many different groups himself, because he also performs for Brooklyn Gypsies, which is a collective all about, like, showcasing diverse poets who might be, like, spoken word poets who aren't necessarily, like, part of the academic lit scene. So I do think it's a nice mixture of, like, quote-unquote academic poets and, like, performance poets, which usually doesn't happen because there's a weird divide in
yeah.
it somehow.
Do you ever get anyone who comes to your classes who, like, as you say, is, like, a software developer or
yeah.
something, who wants to be part of that world, who it becomes clear that the poetry is maybe a part of it, but there's also this draw to be taken into the Brooklyn, New York poetry scene?
For sure. I mean, I was actually just talking about this last night, because last night was my last workshop for my class that I'm teaching,
aww.
Or was teaching. It was super sad to say goodbye, even though it's never really goodbye, because they could just email me. yeah.
I'll friend you on Facebook,
exactly.
Right?
But we were talking about it, because they were like, how do you, like, do this? Like, how are you so successful and network so well? And I'm just like, you just go to readings and you just keep going to readings and, like, you make friends. And it was really obvious to me that on one hand, like, a lot of these poets, like, really want to become part of the community, but it's also interesting because there's, like, this idea that, like, you're not part of it unless you're successful, which is not true.
That's interesting.
And I think, like, there's, like, a lot of, like, it's easy to feel like an amateur, I think, if you haven't published a book. But I think even if you have published a book, like, the whole imposter syndrome's, like, holds true. And, like, we always think there's, like, a gatekeeper above us, when that is partly true and partly not, I think. I think a lot of it is, like, attitude and, like, us thinking that we're, like, not good enough. So a lot of, like, students last night, they were like, oh, one of them in particular is just like, I'm never going to get published because I write in meter. And I was like, that's so not true. But if you never submit your work, like, you're not going to be published because no one's going to be, like, asking for work unless you've already...
The poetry god doesn't come down. Ah, yes, perfect. This is what I was looking for. Let me put it in my poetry journal.
Yeah, so how do you get all these different kinds of people to write? How do you actually mentor them?
So I guess for me, like, I guess I'm pretty structural when it comes to my classes. And because I used to be a high school English teacher, I think, like, I've had to learn how to actually get people who hate writing to write. So I sort of devise, like, little schemes to do that. I think in this case it's easier because these are people who obviously want to take the workshop.
Yeah.
But in this case, like, I usually use a lot of multimedia, so it's not just about writing. It's about, like, sort of harnessing, like, your own perceptions and memories and images, and then turn it into a piece of writing. So something that I do is I would often, like, play music and just have them write to the music, or I play a scene of a movie and be like, well, why was this, like, full of suspense and tension? Like, why did you want to keep watching the scene? So then I would try to make them write their own memory in a way that, like, would make me want to read it. But I would only give them, like, say 10 to 15 minutes in class to do it. So they would have to actually say something because I'd make them read it. So they couldn't just pretend to have done the assignment. They had to actually do it because then I'd go around the room. But then I would also just give them prompts. Like, for each class, I would always give them assignments. But I would try to make them fun, like, write 10 apologies or write in the persona of, you know, a dead person. Like, really, really weird things. So it's almost like they were so intrigued by the topics that they had
to write about them. I love write 10 apologies. I feel like that's a writing prompt I'm going to do for myself.
It was actually pretty interesting to see what people would do, because I wouldn't even say that it had to be a true apology. So it was also interesting to see, like, what people would interpret a lot of these things as, because some people would be super literal, whereas other people would, like, pretend to be, like, an animal writing an apology. Or, like, if you're, you know, I said you're a dead person, some people chose inanimate objects. So it was always interesting to see, too, like, what came of the writing prompts. But I think also just, like, I was always very, I try to be as, I guess, calm and, like, soothing about these things. So, like, I never make anyone feel like they're an amateur. Like, I think it's always important for me to make everyone in my workshops feel like they're my peer. And I think that's the thing, too. It's like, you're never going to have great results if you are, like, pretending that you're so much better, because no one really is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that that's so true. And I actually joke about this with, like, in regards to Christine a lot. Like, I'll be like, yeah, Christine just, like, acts like we're on, like, the same level. And
be quiet. Because
she loves me so much. And I just, like, go along with it. But it's true when people treat you like they're your equals, and, like, what you, like, are accomplishing and, like, what you're doing. Like, you just sort of rise to it.
And, like, you feel confident about it. And I think that's the thing, is that as long as you feel like you can do something, you probably can. Especially when it involves writing a poem. It's not like it's like climbing a mountain. You have to do, like, crazy amounts.
Hopefully not.
Yeah.
What are the different themes that you've had for the workshops?
My first one was called The Sexual Self.
Ooh.
Which is, I know, right? It was all about writing about your sexuality and sexual identity, which I think was really hard for people, because it's not like writing love scenes. It's writing the real shitty, awful stuff that happens to you a lot of times, because most sex is terrible. And then the second one was crafting line breaks, which I think was my favorite topic maybe to write about, or to teach about, I should say, because I think structurally the way you write a poem is how the story will unfold. And I think, like, that's true of fiction to some extent too, but I think poetry even more so is kind of like a film, where it's like, if you film like a storyline through flashbacks versus present day. Like, it changes the story completely, similar to like poetry that way. And then the current one that I'm teaching is narrative poetry, which is kind of going off of that thread of like, how do you tell a story through poetry and do it in a way that's compelling and provocative, but also not confusing.
Did anyone write anything related to the election or politics?
Yes. Oh yeah. I mean, I think, what was it? The second to last workshop, because it was separated by Thanksgiving, we took a week off.
For the better.
Exactly. So one of the workshops was 2 days after the election. So we definitely talked about the election, and I had them write election poems because I was like, well, we might as well utilize this narrative thread because we're also upset by it. It was really interesting to see what people came up with. I mean, it's so hard, I think, to write about because we still don't entirely know how to parse through all of it. But I think we did spend like a good hour just like sitting there upset, just saying pretty much the same things over and over. But I think it was really cathartic, if that makes
sense. Yeah, of course. I mean, outside of your teaching life as a poet, as an editor, what are the different ways that you've responded?
Mm-hmm. So for me, I was solicited by Tarpaulin Sky to write a poem, and I actually just happened to write one anyway because I was at work and upset, and it was like the day after the election.
Because you're a poet and that's what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how you process.
And for my job, I have to write media and newsy thing. So I was writing about like the election the whole day, and I was like, I can't keep writing about like a report after a while. So I had to write a poem. So I wrote a poem, kind of basically starting from like being a New Yorker at 9/11 and then kind of going up to the present time in the election. So I did that, and I felt pretty, I guess, cathartic about it. And then I felt like, okay, I've sort of slog through my own feelings as opposed to writing about it in a journalistic sense, because it's just two different mediums, because you can't really have an opinion when
right.
you're a journalist. But then for Yes Poetry, the magazine that I founded 7 years ago, I guess, at this point, which makes me feel old, I started a Not Trump series because I felt like everyone's writing these essays about it and like reacting in news ways, but I felt like there wasn't really a good place for people to actually just like submit creative work. Yeah. So naturally I felt like I had to open that up to people, and it's been really interesting to see what people send, and especially, you know, diverse voices, like people who come from all sorts of backgrounds, like Latino, African-American, people who are queer. Because I think that's the other thing, is that a lot of times when I've read pieces, they've all come from very similar voices, especially when it's like popular news sites. I feel like a lot of the times, like, it's the same white dude voice.
Yeah, it's the elite guy. He went to Harvard. He
exactly.
got his internship at the Atlantic. And here's what he thinks.
Now, but doesn't it make you so angry that that's the guy who's like, and now the Nazis are coming
sure.
and Trump is here? And you're like, yes, I agree with what you're saying. But I actually find that a lot of the people after the election who seem like they'd be the most affected, if y'all just been like, all right, get your war helmets on.
Sure.
Just like, we're not playing this game anymore. Like, this is all about survival and it's about protecting each other. And I don't know if you guys feel this way, but I just like don't have time for those like liberal think pieces anymore. Mm-hmm. I just feel like they've failed us in such a profound
sure.
way. But what do you think that poetry can show us about the election that like a think piece doesn't?
Well, I think with a think piece, it's automatically trying to be smart and say something
right?
that it feels other think pieces haven't said. Whereas I think with poetry, it's less, you know, I guess pretentious and more about the personal. And I don't think think pieces are bad intrinsically, but I think when you're writing a poem, a lot of times, especially in this case, you're writing it through your own personal lens and you're not trying to prove anything. to anyone. Because in a, you know, nonfiction essay, you have to have, like, some kind of theory or thesis that you're, like, trying to prove and persuade people to believe by the end of it. Whereas with a poem, that doesn't actually work that way. You're writing more about an experience. And I think that's the thing, is that we all hopefully will learn with this election, is that there are many voices and many marginalized voices that no one really thinks about in mainstream media. And, like, this is a way to, like, sort of actually hopefully try to put yourself in their shoes for at least a moment.
Yeah, so what are some of the different experiences, the different voices that are coming through in these poems for Yes Poetry?
I think a lot of women who've been sexually assaulted are definitely, like, a huge part of the reaction that I've gotten. And, I mean, I think that makes complete sense, because a lot of these women have been routinely ignored by media in general. Like, even though we've, like, had magazines like, you know, Bust and Bustle and, like, etc., publish sexual assault essays at the same time, the fact that, like, Donald Trump was able to, like, make all the comments that he made and, like, no one really called him out on it in a real way, like, also shows that, like, sexual assault survivors aren't taken seriously. So I think there's a huge, you know, backlash. But then I've gotten a lot of poetry from people who do identify as queer or who are, you know, Latino, and they're just really angry because, again, like, they've never really been spoken to by politicians. I mean, as much as I can say I was a Hillary Clinton supporter, at the same time, like, was she really talking to any of these people? I don't really think so. And I say that just as someone, like, who does identify as queer. Like, I don't think she was really talking to queer people. I think she was mostly just talking to the same liberals that listen to, like, NPR, basically. Which I don't think is, like, necessarily a direct criticism. I think it's the unfortunate, like, thoughtlessness that comes into a lot of campaigning and media, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you're forced to. When I was watching the campaign, I just remember being like, Hillary Clinton is not the woman to bridge this divide. Like, as much as I've desperately wanted her to win, like, I just kept thinking, like, you just have the party splitting in two ways, and she's trying to be this progressive moderate.
Sure.
Which is something that isn't really working. Actually, this is the question that, like, I really kept meaning to find a place to put forth. What is the mood at Kveller? Which is the Jewish parenting blog that you edit at.
Yeah, so that is really liberal. I mean, I would say, like, we've never had a pro-Trump piece ever.
I mean, there's definitely
a lot of Jewish pro-Trump supporters. Yeah. And that's
interesting. They think they're white people now.
It's true. And the funny thing is that we've never had a submission. Like, we've never actually received pro-Trump submissions. Mm-hmm. And technically, like, we're part of a nonprofit organization, so on one hand, we try to be neutral in the sense that we want to show, like, all point of views. So it's not like we're specifically only trying to show, like, pro-Hillary point of views. I mean, we're definitely a liberal blog and, like, very much, like, pro-queer, LGBTQ, everything. But the writers that we have just are not conservative. Mm-hmm. But sometimes we have conservative commenters. So that's also what makes it interesting, is that we'll, like, publish really liberal pieces, but then a lot of, like, our commenters tend to be like, oh, but you guys are so biased and this is terrible. And so it's, like, a really interesting thing, because we often have to moderate really, like, political bashing opinions. And I mean, I think the thing that's also very difficult too is, you know, a lot of our readers are very, very liberal, but I also think there's also a lot of, like, there's a huge age range, too, with our readers. Because we have either, like, I would say Gen X readers who are, like, you know, around, like, 35, 40 or so. But then, like, we have, like, a small pocket, I guess, of older who are maybe 65 or so. And I think you can definitely see the differing opinions between the generations themselves, which I always find interesting. I could probably be more educated about it if I was, like, with my Google Analytics here. But no, I think it is a generational thing, too, more than anything. Because I think the younger commenters tend to be more liberal versus older commenters.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a really interesting piece for them recently about the new Harry Potter movie and what it teaches kids about anti-Semitism. Can you just, like, give a recap of that?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a huge Harry Potter fan. Like, I'm not going to lie.
No reason to.
So I will try to find any Harry Potter spin that
bless,
I can.
As we must.
And I grew up with it. So, I mean, it makes sense. Like, I was 11 when the book came out. So I was, like, the perfect age. So I ended up seeing the new movie, Fantastic Beasts. And, I mean, if anything, it was, like, really uncanny for me to see it because it is obviously a movie set right before World War II, and it's, like, all about Grindelwald wanting to destroy the world, similar to Hitler. Mm-hmm. And, like, in the book, Grindelwald is captured in 1945. Like, obviously parallels.
Analogous.
Yeah. The end of World War II. And in the movie, like, there's, like, this whole film starts with, like, newspapers being shown with, like, headlines with, like, oh, Grindelwald is in Germany, or when, you know, he's here, blah, blah, blah. Like, so it was a very clear indication for me that this was commenting also on our current political climate. And I think when I saw it, like, when I was writing for it about the piece, I was thinking to myself, like, what would I teach younger kids? Because since I did used to be a high school English teacher, I often, like, try to, like, find the teachable moment in things, especially since I'm writing for Parent magazine. So I think I was just thinking back, like, what is it actually saying, especially in this landscape of, you know, Trump land. And I think a lot of times, like, it was obviously, like, making comments about how difference is not a bad thing and, like, how we have to stand up, you know, for our beliefs and not just kind of go with what the easier approach is, which I think for now, the current moment, like, there's this strange surge of anti-Semitism again, especially after Trump. Like, all of these, like, swastikas have been, like, you know, I guess spray painted, like, everywhere. Like, I think in that park that the Beastie Boys...
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, there was, like, a park in Brooklyn that was, like, dedicated to, like, one of the Beastie Boys, and, like, that was vandalized recently.
Oh, yeah, and there's all of the... My friend, Barry, she was taking a picture that she found of people are trying to draw horns on, like, Jewish media figures in the subway, and she's like, ugh.
And just those parentheses, such... like, how, like, that became a thing where, like, a lot of Jewish media reporters were, like, were being outed on social media, so then there was the whole question of, like, let's use the parentheses around our names to see, like, to stand up to it. But then that was also, like, hard because it's, like, you're outing yourself as being Jewish and, like, what does that all mean in the sense of, like, owning something that's also, you know, racist and anti-Semitic. But I think with Harry Potter in general, not just, like, the article that I wrote, I think a lot of it is, like, political commentary on, like, say, if you, like, look at the wizarding world and the non-wizarding world, it's, like, who's being racist? You know, like, obviously, like, you can look at wizards as being, like, a marginalized group. So I think you can kind of, like, fit it into any, like, marginalized narrative. Especially, like, not to get too deep into it, but, like...
No, go there. I want to...
Do it.
You know, like, you have characters like Lupin, who's, like, a werewolf, and he's, like, looked at as a bad guy because he has this disease, and it's like anyone with a disease that's been stigmatized, like AIDS, for example. Like, you can kind of, like, make these sort of comparisons and metaphors, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, as a female poet who has a pretty sizable online presence, how do you deal with different kinds of commenters, different kinds of trolls out there? So they don't always say nice things.
No, they definitely don't. And I mean, I've definitely had all sorts of terrible things said about me, like from being like a baby killer because like I've written about my abortion and just like how terrible it is that I had an abortion, to like when I wrote about being non-binary, someone was like, oh, like you're just like traumatized from your assault and clearly like you've never dealt with it. And like things like that, to them being called like a rape apologist, which is ironic considering I write about my sexual assault all the time. So I think for me, I've just kind of learned to take it with a grain of salt. Like on one hand, I do take comments seriously in the sense that for better and for worse, I'm the kind of person to blame myself for things and like think that there's always ways I could be better, which on one hand is a good thing because I'm always questioning myself, but it could be a bad thing. Like in the past when I was younger, I didn't know how to separate myself from like trolls, so I would like take every comment like super seriously and like cry about it because I'd be like, I'm wrong and I'm doing all of this terribly.
It hurts to be wrong. It's almost easier to just assume you're wrong all the time because at least you have some sense of control, right?
Exactly. But then like I got older and I started to like have more like perspective and just also realize like people leave really nasty comments because they're unhappy people. So it's like just kind of about like being diplomatic and like thinking the best of people, but then also realizing like people just say mean shit on the internet and like it sucks, but like I just ignore it at this point because I've definitely written things where people tweet at me and it's just like crazy. And it's like something as simple as like I wrote about a Muslim woman who won like a Miss USA contest and someone thought like I was being like somehow too liberal by like reporting about it on Kveller. They were like, what does this have to do with being Jewish? And I'm like, if you can't see the connection, like, I can't help you. You know what I mean?
I can't make all the connections for you. You have to like make the jump with me.
Yeah. Use your brain.
Exactly. But then I, you know, I realized not to comment back or not to like tweet back. So I'm like, what is this going to be? Like just an inflammatory war.
Yeah.
So I think for me, I also just like try to always be positive, but honest. So I think on one hand, like I think being honest and authentic on your social media accounts is really important because I want people to get to know me as a writer and an activist. Because I think if you're really trying to change the world, you can't pretend it's happy and fluffy all the time and that you're eating sushi and like hanging out with your BFFs like every moment.
I was about to ask, does it help to have like a girl gang of writers when you encounter all of this negativity around writing? And
for sure. I mean, it always helps to have people like advocate for you. Because I remember I posted a selfie of myself over the summer in shorts, and like one guy was just like, you're just trying to be sexy.
Yeah, and like, wearing shorts.
And I was like, oh my god. And before I could even comment, like a bunch of my female friends were like, fuck you, dude.
Attack!
And it was like 30 comments later when I finally commented. But it was kind of great. Like he was so like outed by everybody. So like that definitely helps. But I think it's also like good to keep perspective that like I try to always like remember that everyone is like a human on the other end, which is why I do feel it's like best to be positive in like a very honest way, because I do think like it's easy to be like, this is the worst and I'm gonna call someone out, and it's like that's not helpful, because also that's why people get defensive and never learn, because they just feel like they're being like outed by the other side.
Well, you do such a beautiful job of being honest in your poetry, and we'd love to hear you read some poems from your new book.
I will gladly read some poems. I'll bring the mood down. I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, buddy.
Tell us a little bit about Marys of the Sea before you do.
So this is my third book that I wrote specifically about my sexual assault and the abortion that I had as a result of the assault. And I did kind of write about it a little bit in my first book, but in this one I really took it on, like, within this persona of Mary Magdalene and Mother Mary. So I think with that being said, I'll just start reading the poems. So this first one is called Creation Myth. You ask me why I never pressed charges. I drink the rest of my gin and tonic, begin to tell you how a man discovered eternal life in 1988. He found it on the ocean floor. Instead of dying, jellyfish age in reverse, bury themselves until tiny flecks rise and gleams, endlessly rocking. An injured Medusa will sink and reabsorb into the ocean floor. It will wait. Eventually, a polyp will form to reproduce a Medusa. The easiest way to make a jellyfish regenerate is to mutilate it. It does not feel when attacked. Someday I won't feel anymore either. We both play dumb when the bartender asks if we're okay. I rock my chair the way a mother rocks her child, ocean rocking a sailboat in arms of salt. Self-control is difficult for humans. Our heart's still primitive. I scratch at skin until a new layer reveals impermeable. In the dim light of the bar, all the bodies so dense, pores secreting black, they almost disappear. When it's time, you ask my name. Look for J's, you'll find them everywhere. 24-hour diners, cliffside harbors in low sunlight, hotel rooms with unsure women. I was there once, in a room with a man. It was late winter in a big city where lights no longer cared about sounds during sex. He taught me how to keep my body still and thin as pine needles, how to listen to Billie Holiday cry in the back seat of my car, how to take a pill so a child dies, how every spring fewer azaleas stay in bloom. I smelled my cunt souring, something gone wrong, violence never far from the hands of men. Hands around neck, my life still believing in the yet to be. The future has changed. Early bloomer, still waiting for the one poem that will bring me home. I didn't tell you how I used to think of all the ways to fall in front of cars, sacrifice my body to get what I had before. I used to pray for a new body by moonlight, a return to being human. I leave without giving you my name. I do not believe in punishment. This next poem is called Birth of Dionysus. Lion jumps through elephant craniums. Fire whizzes, moss-ravaged jaws. Jade clouds seem dawn. Someone forgot to close the gate. His mother is alone, mostly on knees, curling plumed serpents. Around black fog, day moon eclipses her womb into a book of names. This next poem is called The Formation of a Black Hole. One. My lover and I need to cross a bridge. It is changed closed for the night. My lover climbs over, leaves me to hunt antelope, distinguish poison from sustenance. X marks the X. I take a piece of charcoal and draw until my body is covered. 2. Found dead, my lover stolen, hooked up to machines, his tongue pickled in salt, extracting new blessings. It says, do not tempt. 3. My lover still, us unfound, his particles move in mephitic air. My lover is a hypernova. I cut apple skins, pour 2% milk into a jug, any size, keep pouring until it sucks my vulva outside, until he screams on the other side of the house. The hummingbirds are gone. And the last poem is called A Disease Called the Virgin. 1. The virgin walks into a bar, orders scotch, and says, I took a man home last night. I think he's dead. He never woke up. 2. The virgin walks into a bar, says, someone, please take me home. But don't love me. He made that mistake once. It killed him. 3. The virgin walks into a bar and says, I wanted to marry a poet so I wouldn't have a green lawn like everyone else. Orders a rum and coke. Everyone is asleep but him. Soaks her fingers in whiskey. Touches, then generations come, then a pulse, his pulse. 4. The virgin walks into a bar, sits on a stool, and says, so this is the new world, still king deep, still making love between a meat grinder and a man's corpse. All the women in her still and tired, all the women tired inside her. 5. Someone at the bar wakes up, walks over to the virgin, scrapes together 2 stones. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, wow.
Why did you need to write this book?
I think for me, as someone who dealt with this trauma of being assaulted and then uniquely becoming pregnant from the assault and then having to make that decision to abort the child, especially when I was 21, I think I felt so much guilt at the time, especially because I come from a family who is super religious and opposes abortion, and even though I had already been very much like crazy progressive liberal at this point in my life, like I think I still carried around this like cultural guilt because I sort of felt like I had something terrible happen to me, but now I'm doing something terrible, even though I knew I wasn't doing anything wrong. But I think like I didn't really have a support system at the time that I felt comfortable talking to, so I instead like wrote poems about it. And of course, like dealing with the shame that comes with assault too, because that was the other thing for me, is like I don't really lost my virginity like a year before I was assaulted. And I came from a family, again, being conservative, they're very into like waiting to have sex until marriage and like shaming you if you did that before. So I think I just like had all of these like crazy, like, contradictory emotions that I sort of had to, like, objectively get out. And I think writing a story through this, like, persona helped me, like, objectify my own experience in a way that I could see that I wasn't wrong. And, like, I didn't do anything wrong. I also think I also wanted to somehow, like, connect to other people through my writing, if that makes sense, because I think I found it easier to write these poems and put them out there as opposed to just, like, talking to my friends about what happened. And I did, like, talk to them, but, like, usually not necessarily right away. I mean, I think I only really opened up to people when I was in grad school about what happened to me, and I started writing this around that time. And I think in some way, too, like, we just sort of write about what we're obsessed with. And I think, like, unfortunately, like, you just become obsessed with your pain in a, you know, strange way where it's like you don't want to. It's not like you want to be depressed. But depression is, I think, so much easier to focus on than happiness, because I think we often feel like our happiness is going to be fleeting. So it's almost easier to also, like, get stuck in this, like, vicious cycle.
There's an indulgence to depression sometimes.
And I think I realized too at the time, like, I needed to write about it to get over it, as opposed to being in this cycle, because I couldn't really afford to go to, like, a lot of therapy at the time, because I was a, you know, college student and then a grad student. So, like, I definitely went to therapy a little, but, like, I couldn't go for, like, extensive periods of time because my, you know, healthcare provider didn't cover all of that, and then I didn't want to, like, ask my parents to, like, support that, because they didn't even realize that I had been assaulted until last year when my mom read an article about it that I had written. So, I mean, that was something I'd been trying to shield pretty much forever until, like, she just basically found out about it herself. Because, you know, at least for me, I can say, like, telling family was and is, continues to be, like, the hardest thing for me. And I think especially because even though we love each other a lot, we have, like, completely different opinions about all of this. So it often becomes, like, how to safely navigate for me and for them.
How much do you share with your parents?
Probably, like, not a lot.
So I mean, they're not going to listen to the show.
No. I mean, like, if anything, I need to say, like, I, like, block my parents on, like, social media stuff. I mean, I think I tell them a lot considering everything. And, like, I'm the kind of person where if you ask me a question, like, I will answer it. But I think I often try to, like, be a version of myself to my parents.
Oh, yeah. I think to an extent we all definitely do. I often feel like I can only be the daughter that my parents deserve to have for, like, 3 hours at a time.
Exactly. Yeah.
So have your parents read your books?
They have my first one, because I know they were, like, when my first book came out, they were like, oh my god, this is amazing. So they wanted it, and I gave it to them. And they did. My mom read it, I know for sure. And she enjoyed it in the sense, like, you know, as much as she could. But I think my mother also, like, she does read my writing online. I never send it to her, but she'll Google and all that fun stuff. And I think she's definitely proud of me as a writer, but she also doesn't understand it or necessarily enjoy it. I mean, I think it makes her uncomfortable, and I think the details about sex just are not her thing. But I think she also comes from a completely different generation than I do. I don't think she's read this book, because I haven't given her a copy, so she has never technically read it. If she asked for one, I would give her a copy, but I'm not, like,
jumping at the bit to give your mom this happen, book.
Especially because it is very critical of Christianity, and they're, like, super religious, so I don't think she would appreciate all of the wonderful things that I have to say, since it is a persona, so it's, like, technically implying that Mary was raped, and it's like, who raped Mary? And that's kind of the thread of the book.
Can we talk a little bit about your new chapbook?
Sure.
Zena, so that I've heard described as a bit of an immigrant narrative. And so how is it an immigrant narrative? Was that a choice you made purposefully? Did it just come out?
So I think It actually came out, I guess. Maybe it's a half and half. Like, I guess I suppose I did purposely set out to write the story of my grandmother because she lived a completely fascinating life. And she is part of an immigrant culture just because, you know, she's Greek and her parents came over from Greece right when she was born. So even though she was technically born and raised here, she spoke fluent Greek and she was like part of this very small community that at the time was considered a minority, you know, Greeks and Italians when they came over from Ellis Island at the turn of the century up until the 20s, they were definitely like seen as people stealing jobs from other people. It was like the same repeating narrative that we have now. So when I initially set to write it, I was in grad school and I was in a nonfiction class and I had an assignment where I had to basically write something nonfiction. Because I'm a poet, I'm like, well, I want to write a series of poems. So I wrote the series of poems and for some reason it just occurred to me to like interview my grandmother and talk to her just about her experiences because she ran away from home to join World War II.
Really?
Because that was just something she wanted to do. So I focused actually mostly on that for a while when I initially started writing it, but then a lot of her past came out in terms of like being part of this immigrant culture, and that was really like a huge thread because she changed her name just to be more American. Hmm. And a lot of like the choices that she made in terms of being like conventional and like also true to her parents in the way that she could be, because that was important to her. Where she could only marry another Greek person. Like, she wasn't allowed to marry someone who was not in Greek. So that, like, was another thing that was emphasized in the collection. So I think as I was writing it, it just kind of surfaced more than I initially intended it to. But then it makes sense because she lived most of her life wanting to assimilate into a culture that was more American. Whatever that means. I mean, it basically means being super white and eating, like, you know, American food and being like, leave it to beavers, basically. Which I'm not criticizing her for because that was what you did when you were growing up during the 50s and, you know, the 60s.
I mean, it's a defense mechanism no matter what kind of immigrant you are.
Because you want to be accepted. I mean, everyone wants to ultimately be loved. So in order to do that, you just make yourself more like the people that are around you. I also think, like, being in Brooklyn, because my grandmother grew up largely in Brooklyn and then lived in the Bronx, like, that's also just the sea and land of people from all sorts of different backgrounds. So I think even just writing about New York City automatically, in many ways, becomes, like, an immigrant narrative because everyone's from somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Especially at that point in time where there was, I think, so much of, like, this influx of people, like, moving to the city since, like, Brooklyn, not even, like, 100 years ago, was, like, so much different than it is now. And that's, like, the heyday of, like, the tenements and everything.
It's interesting to talk about. So you're writing about your grandmother, who is basically on, like, the cusp of whiteness of her time, right?
Exactly.
And I feel like that's really interesting and analogous to what I see happening now with certain Latin communities.
Yes.
Like, I have a friend who's Cubana, and she's always talking about, you know, if you suck up to whiteness enough and you're on the cusp, you can get in.
It's true, though.
But
and it's sad.
It's sad. True. She's like, that's why she was saying, you know, there are all of these, like, Cuban Americans who are voting for Trump, and, like, why would they do that? That's so crazy. And it's sort of in the same way that there are a lot of arguments for why Scalia was so conservative, is he's the swarthy Italian man at this time when, like, you're just beginning to claw your way into whiteness.
Exactly. Yeah.
And we've seen this happen, but do you think that there is a fear that even though the expansion of whiteness can be argued as a good thing because you're, like, incorporating all of these different people, obviously the hierarchy of whiteness is awful and something we want to destroy.
Sure.
But you could argue it's something that expanding to encompass more people is good. But is there, like, a negative potential in that being that you have to have all of these sort of minority figures on the cusp of whiteness, like your grandmother, who then have to give up their identities to get in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's always negative. And maybe I'm, like, too, like, I guess, contrary in a lot of ways, but I don't think so. I think in this case, it's just like you're rejecting your own personal identity in order to fit in with like a greater mass of people. And I think in this case too, it automatically implies that whiteness is superior to the minority. Okay. And I think that in itself is like problematic because it's as if you have to change yourself. And I think that for me is always a bad thing, regardless of whether it's racial or like gender or whatever we're talking about. And I also think there's this like idea too of like, what is the point of whiteness? And I think that's the ultimate question, at least, is like, what is it even? What's the point of it?
Once you get in, what do you do with it?
Especially if like you're not even a man, because that's the thing. It's like the white man is like the one that's been routinely in power throughout history. So it's like women aren't even getting all of the power. So it's like kind of also raises that question too, if like you don't fit into this, or if you're a gay man, like there's so many like ways that you're still always going to be different too. So then I think it's kind of sad, not even in just a political sense, but there's going to be so much repression. And I think with repression only comes like really terrible, like emotional, like traumas.
Do you talk to your grandmother about that? Like, does she regret, I guess, what she gave up, or does she seem to, or is she pretty pleased?
Oh, she's, I would say, like, doesn't even think about it that way. I think, like, it's easy for maybe me and us to look at it this way because we're objective, or more objective than she is. But, I mean, she will consider herself white. And I don't think she necessarily looks at it as a bad thing because she's super patriotic. And I think a lot of World War II veterans are, because they feel like they gave up a lot for their country for, like, a greater good. And, right, of course, in many ways they did. But I think she sees herself as so American that she could never see herself as anything but that. And I think that's the thing, is that her own parents were like, you're American first. Even though she's really super before Greek. Greek.
But she could only marry a Greek man.
Exactly.
But, like, America Greek, right? Yeah.
So many contradictions, but I think like they were so afraid of being outsiders that like she's at this point 93, so it's been like such a long time since all of that, but her like overall whiteness I think has sort of overreached anything.
Yeah, well, we have to wrap up in a bit, but I was hoping you could answer one last question about your grandmother and just how you've come to understand her differently as a person since writing the book.
I think pre-writing the book, I'd always kind of looked at my grandmother as being kind of like a mini celebrity, if that makes sense, because she's like super feisty, outspoken. She doesn't consider herself a feminist, but like, you know, she's very independent. And even though like she was married and like largely relied on her husband, like for financial purposes, like her emotional life was definitely like not submissive to anyone. I think I always admired that as a kid. But I think after writing this collection, I really saw like so many things that she gave up or never got to explore about herself. And it made me feel kind of sad, especially because she doesn't necessarily realize them, or because like she has so many anxieties and fears of her own that like have stopped her. And just like the fact that like she only met her sister once because her sister lives in Greece and they were like separated at birth, and like a crazy story that I'd never really known until I asked her about it.
Wow.
So it's like so much trauma.
Gosh, that's a whole other radio show.
It's crazy.
Well, thank you so much, Joanna.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you being here. Folks, you've been listening to the Badass Lady Folk of Brooklyn. I'm Christine Stoddard.
And I'm Mari Pack.
And tune in next week.